information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight we care.
Appear to border on fence.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
So you think that money is the root of all evil? Have you ever asked, what's the root of money? Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the 199th episode of Media Monarchy. It's December 17th, 2010. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, black magic money, mercury fillings and serial killings, news purge, suicide and deathbed conversions, plus our in-studio guest, Tracy R. Twyman, discussing the alchemy of money. Money grows on the tree of knowledge, my friends. Second hour in-studio guest, Tracy R. Twyman, here on the 199th episode of MediaMonarchy.com.
Yeah.
Black Magic. That's Jarvis Cocker from his self-titled debut record from 2007. And Black Magic is quite fitting for our 199th episode of Media Monarchy, my friends. Welcome. I don't know what to say. I just have a huge thanks to throw out to all the folks, short-term, long-term, who have been around to support the Media Monarchy empire, if you will. It's just after 10 a.m. Pacific time here, December 17th, 2010, coming to you live, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and, of course, all the other fine affiliates that carry Media Monarchy, help spread the message around the country and, indeed, around the world. ZeroPointRadio.com, blasting worldwide, simulcast as well right now, 92.3 FM and 1670 AM in Casper, Wyoming. The worldwide home of free speech, revereradio.net, frolympia.org, berkeleyliberationradio.net, oneskyradio.com, stickam.com/groundzeroradio, 89.9 FM, Patriot Radio in La Mesa, Texas, and of course, thanks to Glenn at kboo.info, that's kboo.info, Jeff at radio23.org, and of course, all the fine folks at tragedyandhope.com. You can, of course, make contact with me, facebook.com/mediamonarchy, twitter.com/mediamonarchy, and on, MySpace and YouTube and Ustream, which is being a pain in the ass, and so we are not streaming live video as we speak. We are recording it just straight to the hard drive. We're on Blip, Podomatic, Cafe Press, Skype, Instant Messenger, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, Archive.org, and of course you can send your news tips and hate mail to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com, and we implore you, if you find independent alternative media useful and invaluable as you try and navigate through these shark-infested waters, talking heads and double agents on all sides, please donate to alternative media. You can see the evil PayPal button at the top right of MediaMonarchy.com. And we want to send thanks again to our friend Christopher in British Columbia for donating again. And thanks to Stephen in Madison, Wisconsin for his first donation to MediaMonarchy.com. And again, we have a P.O. Box. You can send media to the Monarchy. P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon, 97212. That is also written up at the top right of the website. Huge thanks to Henrik Palmgren of RedIceCreations.com. I had an amazing two-hour conversation with him yesterday. The minute that episode drops, I'm going to refeed it out to you guys on the feeds. For the first entire hour, we discuss the WikiLeaks PSYOP and go into great detail on all the assorted characters and all the assorted intelligence connections, of which there are many. So needless to say, we don't have time in this episode to go into all the assorted details. We do go over a little bit on the previous B-Side 198 to MediaMonarchy.com. So go there and you can get the latest. That's also on CyberspaceWar.com. So yes, huge thanks to Henrik. And it was an amazing honor to be on a show that I'm such a fan of and have been a fan of these last several years. 199 today. Tracy Twyman coming up in hour two in studio on the Alchemy of Money. Next week, we're going to take off Christmas Eve. However, there will be a Winter Wonderland mixtape in its place, putting the finishing touches on that little present under your tree coming Christmas Day from the Media Monarchy Kingdom. It can't be news and politics all the time. The Winter Wonderland mixtape number 7 features some of my favorite music from the past year. Again, just another way of sharing information and sharing media and sharing art that we love and that inspires us. So taking off from the live show next week, which will be the 24th, but we will return New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2010, with the 200th episode of MediaMonarchy.com, and I'm planning something a little bit special. Hopefully it's all going to come together and it's all going to work out well, and you guys will be just as stoked and as happy as I am to have reached 200 episodes. And even that's kind of unofficial. What with all our B-sides and interviews and mixtapes and NewWorldNextWeek.com episodes, there's so much more. I think that takes care of all of my business, my dirty, sinful business. We'll take a glance at Google News. WikiLeaks Chief Julian, Dr. Assange Love, is the U.S. pursuing him in secret and saying they face a very aggressive investigation by the U.S. North warns South Korea to cancel military drill. Always the provocative war games going on. Looking to start or strike a spark on the powder keg on the geopolitical grand chessboard. And of course, there's more wheeling and dealing around the giant Ponzi scheme with the name Madoff. So there's that and all the other things on Google News, and we'll maybe keep an eye peeled. As disgusting a metaphor as that is, to see if any news breaks, and we'll try and fix it for you here. Again, my friends, my name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of The Site and Show. I'm glad you're here. This is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Hopefully, a fear-free zone. More information will make you better informed, make better decisions, and not make decisions based out of fear and paranoia, but becoming more informed and maybe not being surprised when things go down. So let's get right into it with the 1216 News Purge Black Magic, named for our opening track. And we'll just run down the list as quickly as we can, as painful as it may be at moments. We'll start with 9/11 updates from 911blogger.com. 9/11 survivor and activist and more, Jeanette McKinley, has passed away from toxic dust. More on her amazing story and all the things you can do to help spread that information and support the family. And of course, I don't know, support the 9/11 first responders. And I did see that, amazingly enough, The Daily Show last night spent their entire final episode of the year discussing the 9/11 first responders. In a semi-related note from the Associated Press, U.S. Senator calls for hearings on plane registry. That's right, we still have no idea what's going on with the funny tail numbers and the shell game there that folks like Daniel Hopsicker look so much into. But let's move to our BioWars EnviroHealth updates. Spanish researchers want to tag human embryos with barcodes. What a brave new world, my friends. White House says science of man-made life can proceed. That's from the French agency press. Meanwhile, right along there, stem cell transplant cures HIV in a guy in Berlin. More on that from the Huffington Post. Now, from ClimateGate.tv, and as a viewer's request on the latest New World Next Week video, we put up the full report that sources this article from PNAS.org. Scientists admit climate change worse before human CO2. Again, that's our first story on the latest episode from NewWorldNextWeek.com. In an amazing reversal, as they twist and turn and seem to be right on some issues and oh so very eugenically wrong on other issues, dental fillings and mercury risks debated at FDA meeting.
Our subject is amalgam fillings, which contain about 50% mercury. Controversial subject. We welcome as our guest Dr. Jennifer Jablow, who is a dentist in New York City. We welcome you to the program.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Good. And I'm going to begin by reading a statement from the ADA, the American Dental Association, from 2006, in conjunction with some studies published in the Journal of the AMA, and they say, quote, dental amalgam contains elemental mercury combined with other metals such as silver, copper, etc., to form a safe, stable alloy. The bottom line for consumers, dental amalgam remains among several safe, effective options for treating dental decay. Of course, the best option is still to prevent dental disease through brushing, flossing, and regular dental visits. So, is that still the ADA's position? And if so, do you agree with it?
Yes, that's still the ADA's position. But even though it has been proven that it's not harmful and there have been studies have been done for about 7 years. So they're really still, the question is open on the long-term effect. So I think that we're still comfortable with amalgams, but I feel like the consumers or our patients are a little weary. And I'm seeing an influx of people coming in asking questions about amalgams and trying to be reassured if it's safe or not, because we don't really know the long-term effects. The studies haven't been of a long-term cohort.
So what do you say specifically to people who come in and say, well, I don't want to take any risk, even though they appear to be safe, I want to have them taken out and replaced with something else?
Well,
what do you say to them?
We don't want to be alarmists here, but at the same time, amalgams are really not the best option anymore, not because that we're so worried about the safety as so much that this technology is so advanced and we have better options for our patients. So don't we want to give our patients the best options that are out there?
Now that everybody's mad about it? See, and those are the kind of things that an activated, informed populace can force these changes. So going along right with that from naturalnews.com, reflecting on the undue influence that drug giant GlaxoSmithKline appears to have exhibited over the FDA's decision-making process regarding the diabetes blockbuster Avandia, Time magazine asked the question in an article titled, "Does the FDA Have a Drug Problem?" The saga over Avandia has embarrassed the FDA and further tarnished the reputation of the already embattled pharmaceutical industry complex. As early as the late 90s, researchers were already sounding alarms over the drug. This is gone into greater detail by Jonathan Emord in his book, The Rise of Tyranny. Doesn't that sound familiar? Does the FDA have a drug problem? Our last BioWars EnviroHealth note again comes from naturalnews.com. Pilot faked his way as a prestigious doctor for 20 years, duping the AMA and receiving millions in medical grants. Yes, we can laugh and say, oh, that's kind of like Catch Me If You Can. But this just gives more credence to the folks who aren't taking what their either pharma-connected doctors or just straight charlatans are dishing out to them. Fortunately, these stories are segueing quite well. And again, it's all a rich tapestry, and we'll find throughout all of these stories, as we have throughout all the episodes and all the years of doing this research with you guys, the stories are all connected. The drug war. Controversial hallucinogen salvia study shows intense novel effects in humans. More on this from fizzorg.com. And I have heard of the drug salvia, S-A-L-V-I-A. And I believe I've even talked to a couple of friends who have smoked it before, in that it is a bizarre, intense experience. New Jersey doctor supplied steroids to hundreds of law enforcement officers and firefighters. More on that from NJ.com in what is an amazing, well-documented, massive report. And they do it in a way, too, that I like. They have it all laid out on a single page. New Jersey doctor supplied steroids to hundreds of cops and firefighters. Protect and serve, indeed. On to the history mystery as we fly through this 1216 news purge, black magic. In the history mystery note, we start from Haaretz.com. It wouldn't be U.S. concern if USSR sent Jews to gas chambers. Kissinger told Nixon on these latest newly quote-unquote discovered tapes. And beliefnet.com reporting on Kissinger's weak defense of these statements, putting them into context for us. These kind of statements, and again, these kind of statements from Kissinger come as no surprise. But we can add this to the list and ask the question again, why would our supposed progressive leaders look to people like this for their marching orders, as they say? What did Jim Jones say? I take my orders every day from Kissinger. Does Hillary say, I take my orders from the CFR? Now, we reported on this a couple of weeks ago, but now even more is spilling out. And again, these kind of situations make you have to wonder if there is some type of revelation of the method going on. Is this the bad guy at the end of the James Bond movie telling us how they did it? U.S. recruited Nazis more than thought, declassified papers show. That's the New York Times headline. Project Paperclip, Nazis, selling of the soul, and it all connects to the old boys, to put it pretty simply. CourthouseNews.com, CIA tries again to duck responsibility for doing drug experiments on veterans. In so many ways, we say this all the time. Even if you believe in the wars or whatever official event and story, their actions after the fact should show you. All I want to say is that they don't really care about us. Lawsuits accuse Knights of Columbus of child abuse. That's from Reuters. And then we get into some of the other related history mystery false flag event stories. FBI first tries to delay release of anthrax attack report. That's from allgov.com. But then a couple days later, the update from bioprepwatch.com. NAS surprised by FBI's release of additional Amerithrax data. It remains to be seen if on any front page newspaper it will come out that Bruce Ivins has been made a patsy in the false flag biolab terror event, unfortunately referred to as Amerithrax. Fascinating interview. Insider reveals the diabolical secrets of the Rand Corporation. And more keeps spilling out about Dr. David Kelly from the Daily Mail, papers which could finally force full inquest. These things ultimately come out. It always turns out that the crazy conspiracy theorists were right, whether that's in movies or real life. And a little update for you on a story we went over, I believe, last week or the week before. But now the bids on Lee Harvey Oswald's coffin are over $28,000. A couple of notes of holy hexes. Church affirms Virgin Mary apparition in Wisconsin. That's from the Los Angeles Times. Yes, it has been confirmed. Virgin Mary was in Wisconsin. Hallelujah. And going right along with this, and thanks to Russia Today for just putting up the raw video of acrobats stripping down topless for Joey Rats and doing their acrobat routine in the Vatican. It's probably one of the funnier things you'll see this week on the web. And you have to wonder sometimes, who gave a green light to do that? And I don't mean to make light of things. And that's something that I get grief for on the New World Next Week videos. Some of the hateful comments. I'm not trying to smirk through the news or act like I'm the smartass that knows everything. I don't even know why I brought it up. It doesn't matter. Let's move to media memes. And we mention in the second hour, which is the subscriber hour of my interview with Red Ice Radio, the Quaid conspiracy. The new article from Vanity Fair is up in its entirety on the website, and we've got it for you with the printable version. It's long. It gets into all the related scenarios. I shouldn't say all the related Star Wacker scenarios. And just skimming it, I've not had the chance to read the entire thing. I was not familiar with the poisoning of Jeremy Piven of Entourage. Unfortunately, the photos they posed for in this article in Vanity Fair make them look silly. The U.S. wanted Bollywood as an ally in the War of Terror. More on that from HindustanTimes.com. Jeopardy, the game show, is going to pit humans against an international business machine. That's right. The Final Solutions Company is going to do their own John Henry battle on Jeopardy. But then it gets darker and more disturbing. From the Daily Mail, 40-year-old Virgin star co-star Shelley Malil jailed for life after stabbing his ex-girlfriend 20 times. And she doesn't die. She didn't die. She had to face him in the courtroom, unfortunately. Meanwhile, A&E is being sued over their involvement of a police raid that trumped up an event that ultimately led to police killing a 7-year-old girl. More on that from allgov.com. And unfortunately, and this has been an insane last week or so, just the interest in the site that has blown up, you know, in a single day. I had, you know, articles pointing to me from PrisonPlanet.com. I got an interview request from Red Ice Radio. I got other interview requests. The site keeps growing and rising, and all the things keep going in a great way that, again, is all thanks to you guys, because I can't really do this all by myself. Spinning too many plates as it is. And just as things kind of seem to ride high, of course, things can smack you down as they so often do. And I guess I debated about whether or not to even cover this and in what way I would want to cover this or not cover it. However, to not cover it doesn't seem right to me, and it would seem to go against most of the things that I do, and I think the show is good because I think my personality comes through. And if you like that, that's awesome, and if you don't, I'm sorry. But I have to be personal, and the, you know, early radio training tells you, you know, don't imagine you're talking to hundreds or thousands or however many people. Just imagine you're talking to a small group of friends, and that's what I've always done. And I think it's easy to do, at least for me, because I can see those friends and I can imagine the folks that I'm talking to. And I think that's how I kind of temper and tailor my show. So we're moving to the murder and mayhem section. And again, it's a slap in the face to show that we can cover all kinds of horrible news and we can become kind of glib to it, of all the insane things that happen. And we even say sometimes, it's like, oh, Jesus, we just, you know, sometimes have to laugh to not cry. But I found out last Saturday that a guy that I know was arrested for first-degree murder. And the stories are all in the Pacific Northwest Press, and I just have one article linked up for you from the Seattle Times. And their headline and most of the other headlines will be some variation of this. Romantic rival held in May slaying of video producer. And I don't even want to read any of this, even as I'm looking at it. And as I'm looking at it, my friends, I'm telling you that I discovered last Saturday that a guy that I know, whose number is in my cell phone, went to a birthday party of mine. Had been to my place as recently as just a few months ago, I think. Seen his mugshot on the Seattle Times. Seen a guy I know's mugshot on Google News. Being a jealous ex-boyfriend, losing it. And then you wonder about yourself, could we should have done more? Is there a way that we could have done more? I have no idea. No idea. It just kind of made us ill, made us want to throw up. So I just, I guess, feel compelled to mention it just for full disclosure, and I don't really know what else to say. It's disturbing, and it's saddening and heartbreaking, and really, and as we're getting close to Christmas time, you know, it even more makes you just like, geez, I just want to go to Fayetteville, West Virginia, and be with family. And I do. So, I'll try and shake that off. And we'll move on. I guess in more ways than one. Sylvie Cachet, a beautiful and talented fashion designer, found dead at the Soho House. And out of New York, and of course from sensational Fox News, and again, now this all feels disgusting. Continuing to cover this kind of stuff after saying, I now apparently know people who are so separated from reality that they're doing things like these. As everything gets more and more insane, that people are resorting to this, and then it comes to a point where it's in your backyard. And unfortunately, the guy I know, who's now going to be in prison for the rest of his life for first-degree murder, was a Marine. And I can't help but think they've been wound up and set free. Would he have done this without the military? I couldn't say. But it's an unfortunate connection. It always seems it's either ex-military or psychotropic meds when these shooter events happen. But we're only going to see it more and more as the new financial world order comes in and the rug gets pulled out from under everyone. And they're going to start to act more and more erratic and bizarre, as we're only going to see as we progress through the murder and mayhem. New York police eye possible serial killer after four bodies wash up at the beach.
And police have a murder mystery on their hands on Long Island.
Four bodies were found near Ocean Parkway on an isolated strip of Oak Beach. Fox 5's Carolyn Gusoff joins us live with that story. Good morning, Carolyn.
Dick and Ty, good morning to both of you. This is a very disturbing mystery. As you said, four bodies found all on the same deserted stretch of Ocean Parkway all over the last couple of days. And Suffolk police saying that this cannot be just a coincidence. The first body was found on Saturday. Police were actually searching this area, an area of underbrush between Oak Beach and Cedar Beach. They were doing a training exercise with cadaver dogs, but they were also searching for a woman, a missing woman from Jersey City. 24-year-old Shannon Gilbert was last seen on May 1st. Police say she was a prostitute and came out to Suffolk County to meet a client on Fire Island and was never seen again. So they were searching this area and they discovered skeletal remains. Sources say that that body was a woman. And then in gathering evidence in that case, in that discovery, they made a very gruesome discovery yesterday of three more bodies, all of them in various stages of decomposition, but police say that they had been dumped recently within the last month. Two of them were wrapped in burlap sacks. None of them are identifiable. Police say they'll have to identify the bodies using DNA and dental records. So the question, of course, is does Suffolk County have another serial killer on its hands? Well, police say, of course, it's too early to know, but they do not believe that this is a coincidence. In fact, the chief of homicide says the common sense would dictate that it's not a coincidence. So if you have any information, you're asked to call Suffolk Police, that number 1-800-220-TIPS. That's the latest this morning from Oak Beach.
As we unfortunately continue through the murder and mayhem, bizarrely enough, I get this story from Iranian Press TV. U.S. serial killer victims may hit 160. U.S. police have released photographs of some 160 women found at the home of suspected serial killer Lonnie Franklin Jr., whom they fear could be among his victims. That's kind of a messy sentence. They found photos of these women at the home of suspected serial killer, known as the Grim Sleeper. And no doubt, you heard the story about the shooter at the Florida school board meeting evoking V for Vendetta, spray painting the V on the wall, pulling out a gun, shooting at the board members, and things get fuzzy there as I don't even know the entire story, but another bizarre situation that unfortunately has disturbing and graphic video. And of course, we have the suicide notes and the manifestos. This doesn't seem to necessarily be politically motivated as much as it seems to be economically motivated. Again, as so many more of these events we're going to see are going to be economically related. What started out as a big story was downgraded quite quickly on MSNBC to false explosives alarm at a Connecticut home. It started out saying, oh my God, there's bombs, it could be terrorism, and then it was M80s. Ah. a little bit on Obamasiah and, of course, all the corrupt criminal cabinet Congress critters. Bernie Sanders has a record-breaking, longest in 27 years marathon filibuster of the Obama, Bush Obama GOP tax scheme that, of course, the wheeling and dealing, and they've worked it out, and I don't even, again, know all the specific details, but it's another success of corporate Congress over us. Press Secretary Robert Gibbs very angry that the Senate is going to read the START treaty legislation before they vote. The nerve of reading legislation before they vote on it, because we don't do that anymore, remember? Jimmy Carter says the U.S. is ready for a gay president. And I would say most folks are just saying we're ready for a good president. The Daily Beast reporting on America's new mercenaries, Obama hiring military contractors at a rate that would make Bush blush. Change you can outsource. And the most recent thing swirling around the District of Criminals we have for you this morning, there was, you wouldn't really know it, tuning into the mainstream Dr. Assange love circus, but a Pulitzer Prize winner, an ex-CIA analyst, an FBI whistleblower, and many more were among those arrested outside the White House in a veteran anti-war demonstration. See, anti-war demonstrations were these events that used to happen where people would get together because they were outraged at the actions an illegitimate government were taking in their name and killing people around the world who were just like us. In case you'd forgotten, so now they're kind of old-fashioned. And perhaps a dead paradigm, but nonetheless. We have a couple of Oregon oddities. This one from Colombian.com caught my eye because it's always an inside job. Washington County, Oregon deputies say a security company owner and two employees have been arrested following a burglary at a church school. The sheriff's office said laptops and other electronic devices have been stolen several times this year from Oregon Episcopal School, but there were no signs of forced entry. The church had hired Northwest Merchant Patrol to check the school after hours. Last Saturday night, a school employee stayed overnight to watch the patrol, watching the detectives, if you will. The school worker spotted the company's owner, 27-year-old Sterling Anderson of Wilsonville, Oregon, and one of his employees, 21-year-old Sheldon McMillan of Beaverton, leaving with what appeared to be stolen property. Deputies then arrested Anderson, McMillan, and a third employee, 39-year-old David Smith of Wilsonville, for investigation of burglary and theft. That's what gangsters do. They like to get into positions of power to where they can abuse their power and their little bit of petty know-how. Oregon security firm arrested in burglarizing places they were supposed to be securing. And I saw it early this morning on the Twitter feed, which, again, will remind you, twitter.com/MediaMonarchy, since I got a Wi-Fi pod recently. Our Twitter feed has gone crazy, constantly retweeting and posting news, just another way to kind of spread this information while we still, fortunately, have a free and open web. CERT unit responds to a shooting in a southeast Portland apartment. Now, I'm sure this was a difficult situation, but it's just another scenario where we need essentially the military to come in and take care of what was probably, again, admittedly a disgusting domestic violence situation. But they roll out the military for everything now. And that's why we're going to get into Police State International now. Bombs pave way for surveillance as Swedes react to terror. That's the way Bloomberg tells it. Pretty much right like it is. Sweden's brush with terror after a suicide bomber on 12/11 detonated himself before executing a planned strike in central Stockholm has eroded lawmakers' resistance to pushing through tougher surveillance laws. The opposition, Social Democrats, will no longer block a government proposal to let the Swedish Security Service use information from the National Defense Radio Establishment. The anti-immigration Sweden Democrats, we've reported on before on NewWorldNextWeek.com as well, Media Monarchy. They entered parliament for the first time in September. Elections want lawmakers to address violent Islamist extremism using the specter of terror. Again, you're far more likely to just get hit by a car than any kind of trumped up terror. That, of course, always has some kind of intelligence-connected patsy who thinks they know what they're doing, but don't really know who their paymaster really is. And that is something we also discuss in the second hour of my recent interview with Red Ice Radio, tying it along with our own event here in Portland. See, they need to ratchet up the controls everywhere. Just as people start to push back, you need to scare the masses with a trumped-up terror event to get them back in line. Swedish military staffer knew about attacks, says report. That is from thelocal.se. Possible bizarre levels of UK martial law as police chief mulls banning protests. Meanwhile, in Italy, Amnesty International and many, many others are praising the increased jail terms in the CIA abduction case. From the Sydney Morning Herald, and I believe it was in the New York Times and Press TV and all around the world, jailed Afghan drug lord was CIA informant. You see a pattern here? Meanwhile, the StarPhoenix.com is reporting, and I believe Dana Gabriel of Be Your Own Leader has now put out a new article on this very scenario, but the Star Phoenix, a mainstream news outlet, puts it pretty simply: Canada-U.S. on verge of North American trade security perimeter. A landmark deal is at hand between Canada and the U.S. to form a trade and security perimeter around the continent with an eye to easing the flow of goods and people across the border. Called the New Border Vision, the pact could be signed as early as January by Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper and American President Barack Obama. It is unofficially anticipated that the plan will be on the agenda when U.S. Secretary of State Hillary visits Ottawa. But officially, the perimeter pact is still below the radar. No such announcement is planned. We don't comment on hearsay or speculation. This is all hearsay and speculation. They're not building the highways already. They're not using the trusted traveler scenarios. They're not building all the corridors of what is the superhighway, whether it's NAFTA or whatever you want to call it or whatever it will be called. And, of course, SPP is now a dead deal, but it served its purpose. It got the ball rolling. People became aware of it. People became activated. People started to speak out. They smack it down, just like they do something like total information awareness. Of course, the name changes, but the agenda moves on. So whether that's the programs or the misleaders, the scenarios are kind of the same. So to further drive home the North American community that Council on Foreign Relations is very excited about, unmanned Mexican drone crashes near El Paso, Texas. Talking Points memo reporting on that. Meanwhile, Danger Room discussing the ginormous drone that will have its first flight next spring. As we reported to you last week of the great success of the spy plane, the X-37B. Now this is good news. Los Angeles dry run drill shows urban nuke terror attack survivable event. This sources back to the USA Today, but I get my paranoia from nationalterroralert.com. The plotters decided to trigger their bomb in L.A. during the morning rush at a metro station a stone's throw from Universal Studios and the set where Steven Spielberg filmed scenes from War of the Worlds. This was no ordinary explosive. This was, as the article calls, 9/11 on steroids, codenamed Operation Golden Phoenix. But they're telling you that when Western intelligence and black ops and rogue sleeper cell agents are activated and false flag nukes go off across the shattered Union, it can be a survivable event, you know, so don't freak out. Meanwhile, in the District of Criminals, the Washington Subway Police to begin random bag checks. And I'm sure, gosh, they're just going to bust terrorists left and right because, you know, they're everywhere. They're hiding under the bed like Bolsheviks in the washroom. But no, it'll be just like the TSA, just like airport security, that the only real bad things that happen are, of course, their fault, with the theft and the lying and the groping and the stealing, letting box knives fly from Tokyo to Portland, missing radioactive tubes, you know, all those things that happen on a day-to-day basis, but it's us. We're the problem. So dump out all your liquid, all in the same bucket, which, if the terror plot was to mix liquids together, aren't you just going to mix it together right there? Take off your shoes. Yeah, we could do whole shows on all the other related TSA scenarios, and because you don't have boobies and all the other bizarre, disgusting stories and all the latest tasering people in wheelchairs and as things go haywire, as the wheels seemingly come off. But we reach the end of this news purge with West Virginia worry. Mission accomplished. Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship is stepping down, and his retirement package includes $12 million in cash, health insurance, a secretary, and a Chevy. The man responsible for the horrible conditions at places like Sago, at places like Montcoal, with the worst mining disaster in the United States earlier this year in my home state of West Virginia. The critical issue to the state, the lifeblood of the state, is also the thing that destroys it. So meanwhile, Congress critters and all the battles going on between the fake left and right. Mine safety bill defeated. So these plants have all had numerous violations. They should have never have gotten to the point that they did. And now a bill that would maybe do a little bit of good, of course, gets voted down because now we're in total partisan fighting mode, which in a way can be a good thing sometimes because generally it seems as though our Congress critters don't really act in our interest. So any kind of deadlock and any kind of lack of activity gives us a little bit of room to breathe. But moving on through the rest of our stories on MediaMonarchy.com, episode 199, my friends. Virginia court rules portions of Obamacare unconstitutional. Obama's health care law loses opening round in court. This is another story we covered on the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. So rather than me rereading the text for you, which you can go get right there, let's take it from the clip on Obamacare unconstitutional.
In a blow to the White House, a federal judge has declared a key provision in President Barack Obama's health care law unconstitutional. The Virginia judge says states cannot force residents to buy health insurance as is mandated by the overhaul Obama signed into law earlier this year.
The goals here were noble in this bill, but even noble goals may only be pursued within the powers of the Constitution. And that did not happen with this piece of legislation.
White House officials were expecting the Virginia judge to rule against them. The administration says it disagrees with the court ruling and believes the health care law will ultimately be upheld.
Our belief is that the Health Care Act is will go forward and that it is constitutional, that it improves people's lives.
Two other federal judges have sided with the White House, and several other court cases are pending across the country. All sides agree that the issue is likely to wind up in the Supreme Court.
The court is split. Basically, there are four liberal-leaning justices and four conservative-leaning justices, and one justice more or less in the center, who is Anthony Kennedy. And it could be that the fate of the health care law comes down to how Justice Kennedy feels about the law.
While it could be years before the High Court hears the case, the provision at issue, whether the government can mandate health insurance coverage, doesn't go into effect until 2014. In the meantime, provisions that have already gone into effect, including one that allows young people to stay on their parents' insurance until age 26, will not be affected by the court ruling.
While the White House says it's confident that the health care overhaul is constitutional, Monday's ruling could give a boost to Republican lawmakers who have fought vigorously against the law. That includes some on Capitol Hill who have vowed to make repealing the overhaul a top priority. Julie Pace, The Associated Press, The White House.
It's a great day for the Constitution today. Today, a federal judge here in Richmond ruled that the individual mandate that every citizen, nearly every citizen, must buy government-approved health insurance is ruled unconstitutional. There are two basic findings in the case. One, the individual mandate is unconstitutional because ordering Americans to buy health insurance, as the bill does, is beyond the Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And two, that the bill is not saved by the taxing power Congress has by applying a penalty to those Americans who do not buy the government-mandated health insurance. As we said after the motion to dismiss this summer, which was round one, every constitutional law case has at least two rounds. Round one was this summer where the United States tried to get Virginia's case dismissed. They were unsuccessful. And then this is round two, the final round, in which the legislation itself was found to be unconstitutional. After the motion to dismiss in August, we noted that we're in the early stages of a long process. We are one stage farther. Nonetheless, this is still going to be a long process. And I would presume, I think it's a reasonable presumption, that this will all end at the U.S. Supreme Court. And while we look forward to getting there, we're much happier to go with a win in round one. When we brought the suit back in March, many of your colleagues in the media and plenty of academics said we had no chance, cast aspersions on our motives, saying such things as this is frivolous, this is politically motivated, and so forth. But the decisions we make in this office are first and foremost governed by the law. And one of the first things, the first thing I did as Attorney General was swear an oath to protect and uphold the U.S. Constitution. And that's exactly what we're doing in this case.
Virginia court rules portions of Obamacare unconstitutional, and we provide for you the flashback to March of this year when this quote-unquote landmark legislation was initially passed. Our headline for you on MediaMonarchy.com, both parties collude to bring U.S. health scare. And we'll just say it yet again for the 100th time. If they really wanted to give us health care, they could deliver it with the same shock and all, death and destruction style. Hey, that guy needs a banana. All joking aside, we'll move to our last couple of stories that, of course, it's all connected. On his deathbed, globalist Richard Holbrooke called for an end to the Afghan war. Let's take it from Kurt Nimmo as we break down yet another passing of another elite-connected crony working the globalist agenda for quite some time. Richard Holbrooke, Obama's point man on Pakistan and Afghanistan, died following a second round of surgery to treat a heart condition. Officialdom and the corporate media are in mourning. Praise for the one-worlder glutted the media. The international community is praising the legacy of veteran U.S. diplomat Richard Holbrooke, who died Monday at the age of 69 while serving as the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, reported the CIA propaganda outfit known as Voice of America. "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan," he told his Pakistani surgeon before he was sedated for his final surgery, according to the CIA's favorite newspaper, The Washington Post. Holbrooke was Bill Clinton's ambassador to Germany. He was a Wall Street investment banker and a senior advisor to Lehman Brothers, the global financial services corporation that cooked its books at the end of each quarter to make its finances appear less shaky than they really were. He was also a former vice chairman of Credit Suisse First Boston. Holbrooke was among prominent politicians who may have received favorable mortgage deals from Countrywide, the failed mortgage lender. Countrywide's VIP program may have bent the rules to offer Holbrooke and his family members a multitude of better mortgage deals, which saved them thousands and thousands of dollars on investment payments. He brokered a quote-unquote peace treaty with Yugoslavia's Milosevic under the threat of NATO airstrikes. In 1999, Clinton unleashed the U.S. military on Yugoslavia for 78 days. The Pentagon dropped 20,000 tons of bombs and killed thousands of women, children, and men. Richard Holbrooke was an ardent globalist, along with the notorious war criminal Henry Kissinger and his boss, the globalist kingpin David Rockefeller. Holbrooke was a member of the American Friends of Bilderberg. He was a member of the board of directors of the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and formerly served on the advisory board of the National Security Network, an organization founded by Rand Beers, who now serves as a bureaucrat in the Department of Homeland Stupidity. Holbrooke was also a member of the globalist outfit, the Trilateral Commission, along with his buddy Henry Kissinger. And, of course, Brzezinski. The CFR, Bilderbergers, and the Trilateral Commission are dedicated to stripping U.S. sovereignty and creating world government. It's interesting, Holbrooke, as Obama's point man in Afghanistan and Pakistan, called for an end to the occupation of Afghanistan. It's tantamount to a deathbed conversion to peace and sanity by a globalist who was responsible in part for the continued destruction of that impoverished country. On his deathbed, globalist Richard Holbrooke called for an end of the Afghan war.
Bulldozer, the nickname the hard-charging Richard Holbrooke acquired in the course of his most lasting bargaining achievement. The Dayton Accord of 1995, the foundation for an uneasy peace treaty between Serbia and its breakaway provinces of Bosnia and Croatia. A deal that Holbrooke advanced by pressing for NATO to go to war against Yugoslavia's Serb leader, Slobodan Milosevic. It was the first time that NATO forces, largely American, had fired a shot in anger, and Holbrooke offered no apologies.
Our goal was to end the war, and by God, we did it with your help here at Dayton. And the war never resumed.
Holbrooke began his Foreign Service career in Vietnam. Vietnam was a conflict Holbrooke described critically in a chapter of the book The Pentagon Papers, The Secret History of the War. Rufus Phillips was Holbrooke's first boss there, working on rural development.
I think he understood, like a lot of people that had been exposed to Vietnam directly, that it wasn't the kind of struggle that the U.S. was going to win by itself, and that sort of became our policy during the Johnson era.
3 years after Dayton, as President Bill Clinton's envoy, Holbrooke was back in the Balkans, threatening Milosevic again unless he stopped his brutal tactics against the secession movement in Serbia's Muslim-majority province of Kosovo.
At one point he said to me, "Are you Americans crazy enough to bomb us over our military security police?" And I said, "Yeah, we are that crazy."
But Milosevic resisted pulling back his troops until NATO warplanes again attacked Serbian territory, this time without UN approval. Holbrooke left diplomacy until another Democratic president, Barack Obama, called him back into service as his top civilian representative to Afghanistan and Pakistan. There, an intractable war against the Taliban has been called Obama's own Vietnam.
General Petraeus himself has said that there's no purely military victory here, that we're looking at an issue which combines a lot of different factors.
Holbrooke's job this time coordinating a strategy of cooperation with two problematic U.S. allies, particularly the Afghan government of Hamid Karzai.
Well, it's not that we pin our hopes on him, it's that we work with him because he's been elected president and reelected.
But Karzai reportedly bridled at Holbrooke's direct warnings to curb corruption. Holbrooke's brand of muscular diplomacy proving to be less productive in South Asia than it was in Southern Europe. His sudden death at age 69 from a rupture of the heart, ending a mission that could have proved his most difficult. Tom Ackerman, Al Jazeera, Washington.
There we have the passing of a globalist, almost to the bitter end. And again, that story has a lot of interesting links and information that we should all use, as always, to keep connecting the dots and keep showing the connections of all our elites and movers and shakers that generally seem to go back to just the handful of corporate-connected elites, gangster, bankster, multi-generational serial killers. So, speaking of, before we even move to our next story, we can just hop back to Google News and note that the feds have nabbed $7.2 billion for victims of the Ponzi scheme from Bernie Madoff. But meanwhile, last Saturday, two-year anniversary of the arrest of Madoff. Mark Madoff. Bernie Madoff's eldest son hangs himself in his Manhattan apartment. This from the Associated Press. Every day for 2 years, he carried the toxic burden of a name that meant fraud to the world. On Saturday, the eldest son of a disgraced financier, Bernard Madoff, hanged himself in his Manhattan apartment, another casualty in the saga that sent his father to prison and swindled thousands of their life savings. On the second anniversary of the day his father was arrested in the worst investment fraud in American history, Mark Madoff, age 46, was found dead in the living room of his Soho loft. He was hanging from a black dog leash while his two-year-old son slept nearby. People close to him said that he was despondent over the press coverage of his father's case. An ongoing criminal investigation of Madoff family members in the multi-billion dollar scheme and his struggle to rebuild his life. The intense scrutiny approaching the anniversary became too much for him, said a person who had recent contact with him, speaking on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the case. Mark Madoff, Bernie Madoff's eldest son, hangs himself in his Manhattan apartment.
Mark Madoff, the oldest son of disgraced financier Bernard Madoff, hanged himself in his Manhattan apartment, according to law enforcement officials. His apparent suicide happened on the second anniversary of his father's arrest in a multi-billion dollar Ponzi scheme that swindled thousands of investors out of their life savings. Authorities say the 46-year-old hanged himself by a dog leash and was found hanging from a ceiling pipe in the living room of his Manhattan apartment as his two-year-old son slept in a nearby bedroom. The child was found unharmed.
There was no note. However, there were some messages sent by email.
Police say hours before he was found dead, Madoff had sent his wife an email to say that someone should check on their two-year-old son. She was at Disney World with her daughter, and she contacted her father, who found Madoff when he went to his apartment.
Just terrible. I think it's awful.
Prosecution of Bernard Madoff for investment fraud happened after Mark and his brother Andrew reported their father to authorities, and the two younger Madoffs have never been criminally charged in the scheme. However, they have remained under investigation and been named in multiple investor lawsuits, accusing them of profiting from the scheme. In a statement Saturday, Mark Madoff's attorney said, "This is a terrible and unnecessary tragedy. Mark was an innocent victim of his father's monstrous crime, who succumbed to 2 years of unrelenting pressure from false accusations and innuendo." Carla Bradley, The Associated Press.
So there's the quick breakdown for you. We do have a related bit from CBS News. Madoff trustee seeks $19.6 billion from Austrian banker. And again, as we glance back to Google News, Madoff trustee reaches reported $7.2 billion settlement. That is currently the top of Google News. But we have a couple of related EconoCrash notes, and we've made reference to it a couple of times, but only briefly, so let's read it into the record. It's official. Ron Paul to lead House Federal Reserve Oversight. Iconoclastic Texas Republican defends WikiLeaks again, says U.S. response an example of killing the messenger. The greatest critic of fiat currency perhaps anywhere in the world is about to take control of a congressional panel that would conduct oversight on the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. This could get interesting. After November's Republican electoral wave crashed a Democratic majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, Ron Paul was one of several ardent critics of status quo thought that GOP leadership thought about empowering. Amazingly enough. There you have it, my friends. Unfortunately, could this just lead to another problem reaction solution situation where we get to audit the Fed and, of course, exposing the mass fraud that's been going on for, these 7, 8 decades? And they'll say, oh gosh, you're right. It is a mess. We just need more control and more power, and it won't happen again, we swear. Now, an amazing one that could have belonged in our holy hexes comes from one of the blogs on Reuters, and the writers, a guy named Felix Salmon, posted under Immoral Bankers. The UK's Institutional Investor Council has issued a blistering report on the excessive fees that investment banks charge companies to issue new shares, fees which one issuer says are, quote-unquote, usually immoral. Usually immoral. We're going to get a lot deeper into that in just a few minutes, but we'll make a reference to our final econo-crash note here for you from Forbes. Former Goldman Sachs programmer convicted for trading code theft. And he's not the first, and unfortunately, he's probably not going to be the last. There you have all the news on MediaMonarchy.com for you. That and so much more is there for you to flesh out. We did that in somewhat truncated form, but we ended with the banksters, with immoral bankers, if you will, to sort of set the table for our in-studio guest who has arrived, and we're going to take just a couple of minutes to get set here, and it's going to be an amazing and interesting conversation about the alchemy of money with our guest, Tracy Twyman.
Money is the root of all evil. Money is the root of all evil. Won't contaminate myself with it. Take it away, take it away, take it away. If a woman calls a man honey, and it's on account of his money, honey and money will soon be gone. Take it away, take it away, take it away. I got the one I love. I got the moon and stars above. I got my youth and health. What do I want with wealth? Money is the root of all evil. Money is the root of all evil. Won't contaminate myself with it. Take it away, take it away, take it away. La 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 la. La 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 la. Haven't got a cent, but don't worry. Haven't got a job, but no hurry. I would answer if they gave me gold. Take it away, take it away, take it away. Got a loaf of bread and wine, baby, and the right to call you mine, baby. For your money, I don't care a bit. Take it away, take it away, take it away. What am I saying?
Friends, bear with us as we get situated here with hour number two from MediaMonarchy.com. We do have our in-studio guest, Tracy Twyman, with us. TracyTwyman.com is the main website?
Yeah. TracyTwyman.com or TracyRTwyman.com. Either one will work. And we have some other websites as well, but they're all interlinked, so you can find them all from going to one or the other.
That's because I think I usually go for the shortest, easiest to remember one, TracyTwyman.com.
Sure, sure. But yeah, we have a website that deals with sort of current events and economics called LibertyCapPress.com. And my books are for sale at quintessentialpublications.com. But again, you can find ads and links all over the other websites. So there you go.
Well, and again, for folks, we'll include all the links. And you had the good idea, and it's funny that I had never really done it before, and it may be because it's hard to have guests booked in advance, as of course we're all spinning so many plates just trying to keep our lives going in addition to doing alternative media. But when you and I had booked this interview, you were like, hey, could you maybe put a link up at the top like you've done for other interviews? It was like, oh, I've only ever put a link to remind folks to go back and pick up an older interview they may have missed.
Oh,
fortunately, I've had the link to you for the last week or so in advance of this interview. So folks that maybe saw it could check it out, see the videos that you've made that mm-hmm. relate to our topic at hand, and kind of maybe be able to do their homework ahead of time. So it was a good move, like, oh, advance notice of a guest being on the show. What a novel idea.
Well, no, it was really helpful to me. I actually gained a lot of hits off of your website, so you must have a lot of traffic, which doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, it seems to ebb and flow. There's sometimes where it'll really spike, and then other times I feel like I've got tumbleweeds rolling around. But it's, you know, the last week or so has been kind of an amazing upswing. I was interviewed on Red Ice Radio yesterday, uh-huh. and that interview is going to come out, I think, here in the next few days. So that was really good to get invited on a show that, you know, that I really enjoy. So the amount of activity, yeah, has really kind of spiked lately.
Well, James, I can say that I know tons of people that have heard about you, know your show, like you, so I'm not surprised at all. I anticipate that the traffic on your website is just going to keep going up and up because, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, you're really one of the rising stars in the whole genre. So
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I think I have only been able to grow by getting connected with folks, whether it's, you know, Corbett Report, but then also our friend Clyde Lewis here in Portland, Oregon, and that's probably how you and I met in the last year or so. We probably met when Clyde was doing his Ground Zero Lounge events in downtown Portland.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of been something I've tried to work on a little more, is getting connected with folks that, you know, that I can go physically see and physically talk to. I mean, it's awesome to connect to folks in Sweden and Japan, but Who are the people in your neighborhood, as the song goes?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's notable liberty, I guess, movements in New Hampshire and mm-hmm. in Phoenix, Arizona, to name a couple that come off the top of my head. That I know that all the people that are into the movement there, they all know each other and they work together. And here in Portland, I've discovered that there's quite a few people that have similar interests, and we just don't work together at all. And uh-huh. it's a little bit strange, you know? So it's like, yeah, we've all got our own thing going on, and we don't want to step on each other's toes. Uh-huh. But at the same time, I think, yeah, it would really be better if we all worked together little bit more often, uh-huh. you know?
And, you know, and then folks like Alex Ansary and even Rex Church, or, you know, just all the other folks who have all their own kind of individual avenues of interest and expertise.
Well, have you noticed that in Portland, okay, everyone sort of feels like they're already free, I've noticed. We have such a, liberal attitude here. And, you can get away with smoking pot, pretty much, for uh-huh. instance. That's just for instance. There's a whole bunch of other things that you can do here without getting a lot of social criticism uh-huh. and without breaking the law that you can't do in other cities. So people feel they're okay with everything here, you know, but it's really, I think it's more of a challenge to get them to understand the larger issues, mm-hmm. and money is probably the main tool that's being used to manipulate the populace, uh-huh. to oppress people. It's the main problem with our society today, is the way the monetary system functions. And I have had a little bit of trouble getting my peers here to understand that this is a real issue, mm-hmm. but it's starting to grow over the last couple of years. It's becoming, you know, blatantly obvious
exactly.
to everyone.
Exactly. It was probably harder to talk about, you know, things, the Federal Reserve, even things like that weren't as openly received as they are now, you know, post 2008 disaster.
But it's amazing. There's actually, you know, there's quite a movement to end and or audit the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. I hear teenagers talking about it, you know, on the bus sometimes. And I get email from people who are really young a lot. Huh. And I'm really surprised that there really does seem to be a movement amongst the young now who they're aware of this issue of the monetary policy. They know mm-hmm. way more about it than their parents or grandparents.
I've noticed recently even a lot of the callers that Clyde Lewis gets on his live show on KUFO are a lot of young guys.
Yeah.
A lot of young guys and girls that call on it, and that's really heartening, I think.
Well, if you think about it, we're probably about the same age.
I'm
thereabouts.
33.
Okay, exactly the same age.
Okay.
And it seems like when I got out of college about 10 years ago, we were already starting a recession,
mm-hmm.
and Apparently, the economists say that there have been ups and downs in between that time, but as far as I can tell, it's just been, it's been in the dumps ever since then, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it may be one of those, you know, one step forward, two steps back is probably more like the likely scenario. But let's actually, before we get ahead of ourselves,
sure,
and get into money,
mm-hmm,
can you give folks just maybe a brief bio rundown of yourself?
Sure, yeah. I started writing about alternative history, and also I got into economics and the Federal Reserve a little bit. When I was 16, I was writing for the college newspaper.
Okay.
And,
where was that?
That was PCC. That
okay,
was around 1993, 94 when I started. Shortly after that, I started a magazine called Dagobert's Revenge, and that was, this is pre-Da Vinci Code, that was all about the same subject, uh-huh, though, of the bloodline going back to Jesus, and the idea that there's royal families that can trace their lineage all the way back to the Garden of Eden, to Sumeria, and it was literally a whole magazine all about the mysticism associated with these holy royal families and the sort of conspiracies that have happened over the centuries to try to keep these people in positions of power. I revealed that through my research that basically most of the important people throughout history, including today, people who are that control a lot of wealth and who have important positions in government, so many of them that you can trace their lineage back to these same groups, mm-hmm, of royal families that go all the way back to medieval Europe, and then you can actually trace them back to ancient civilizations.
And we'll, I'll just interject here real quick that we'll see this come out in the news sometimes with the sort of funny stories of, ha-ha, Dick Cheney and Obama are related.
I know.
Or Bush is, you know, or whoever, you know, related to Vlad the Impaler. And it's usually done in sort of, oh, ha-ha, isn't this funny? A little girl did a science project showing the elite bloodlines, but it's never taken it. You know, it's always done in a tongue-in-cheek manner.
Right. You know, you're given the impression that this is something that we all have, I guess, that, mm-hmm, you know, we're all connected. And that's true. We're all connected, and a lot of people can trace themselves back to a royal bloodline at one point or another. But the specific direct connections where they're literally, like, cousins.
Uh-huh. Yeah, some are, some are more connected than others.
it's just amazing. And, you know, the sort of background that Obama professes and pretends to have, it's just kind of, you wouldn't expect that, but there's so many of these people that they'll have a rags to riches sort of story in, mm-hmm, their background, like the Rockefellers.
Uh-huh.
The first Rockefeller, you know, same thing. He had a poor upbringing, supposedly, but it's so strange when you look at their uh-huh, genetic background that you find their families go back to money and power always.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know what that even means. There's the conspiracy angle. That's the most obvious explanation for that, is that, you know, families just tend to help each other out,
mm-hmm,
and especially if you go to a prep school, that, you know, you have the old school ties with your the other people that went to the school, uh-huh, with you, and so when they have a son and he grows up and is looking for a job, then you'll help him out, things like that. But I also, I think that there may be, because I tend to be sort of a mystically minded person,
uh-huh,
and I actually think that there might be even more to it in terms of actual, like, genetically predetermined destiny. In other words, I know it's hard to explain, but I really think that it's hardly a coincidence that all these people can trace themselves to the same bloodline, and I think that in some instances, yeah, it's these people had no choice but to end up in a position of power in one way or another, that even if they had tried not to, somehow it would have happened.
That they were, that in maybe even some kind of Brave New World way, they've been, or Gattaca, that, you know, they've been engineered to be this way. If you're an alpha or you're a beta or...
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want to weird the audience out too much, but I mean, my research did really go back to the origins of this bloodline, the original kings of the earth, where the idea of kingship came from, and that's why I say it goes back to Sumeria. It goes back to what the ancient people called their gods. They basically, they have these the most ancient civilizations. They have kings lists, like the Sumerians, going back hundreds of thousands of years. And the earliest kings were basically the children of what they called gods. Or sometimes, I mean, actually the earliest kings were gods. And then their sons were considered to be like the human sons of gods. So, I mean, I don't know what it means exactly, because who knows what was going through the minds of those ancient people. But they perceived their oldest kings to be something more than human. And then the descendants that came from there, they felt like, well, they have this special blood in them, and they have a divine right to rule. And I don't know if it's true or not, but I tend to kind of think that there might be something to it, you know? That if you have a bloodline going all the way back to whatever they were, angels or space aliens or whatever you want to think that they are, that that's going to have an impact on your genetic makeup, and that's going to last for generations.
And they sure seem to act as though that's the reality.
You know, yeah, I mean, it's another thing that I'm sure that you've found looking into conspiracies and alternative histories, that these people, the elite, a lot of times they grow up in families where they're taught that they are special by the nature of their birth, and in fact that the earth is sort of theirs to inherit. And there's also a tremendous amount of responsibility sometimes put on these children of elite families. I was just watching the Rockefeller story last night, the whole family, and they were talking about how basically after the fortune was made with Standard Oil, that the family felt, especially the patriarchs, they felt so guilty about it. They felt like, oh, now I have all of this money, therefore I have a tremendous responsibility to the public. That there's some Bible verse he used to quote, to whom much is given, much is required. So the next generation of Rockefellers, they took it upon themselves to distribute a lot of this wealth through philanthropic efforts.
And foundations.
Yeah, a lot of the nonprofit foundations that, you know, fund PBS and things like that, a lot of times it's a Rockefeller associated organization.
PBS, NPR, yeah, you'll always hear, you know, Rockefeller, MacArthur, you know, Carnegie, all of those, you'll hear those names.
Yeah, so much of the money going into nonprofits is coming from these old money families. And the thing is that they literally thought it was their responsibility to remake the world, and that they were, you know, they thought they were doing something to improve the world. Now, you know, what that means, again, is subjective, because, yeah, if you take it upon yourself that you're going to engineer society, then you're sort of, that's, in my opinion, that's taking on even more responsibility. Then you are literally at fault for the things that happen that result from your actions. To me, it's sort of a megalomaniacal thing to do. I think that anyone who assigns that sort of authority to themselves, it's kind of insane in a way. But it's what tends to happen when power and money coalesces in a single family.
So to go back to your research, then into the bloodlines, then led you to where after that.
Well, after finishing my first book, which was The Merovingian Mythos, which was about the bloodlines, I decided I needed to learn more about some of the other influences in society besides royal bloodlines. And I focused on money. I said to myself, I need to find out what sort of esoteric hidden principles are involved in the monetary structure as it stands now, and then also the history of money. So that's what led me to do the research for my my first book, Solomon's Treasure. My first book about money, that is. And basically, I discovered that the origin of money came from religious temples, that it was a religious and mystical concept at its very origin. The first coin money that was made was, again, in Sumeria, in the temples of Ishtar. They had an institution that they called sacred prostitution. Basically, people who worshipped Ishtar would come with a bushel of wheat to donate to the temple, and then they would get a coin in exchange for that. It was called a shekel. Then they could use that coin to visit the priestesses in the temple, and what that meant was they were going to have sacred sex. And so it was sort of a simulation of having sex with the goddess. The priestess would stand in for the goddess, but she would get paid for doing it. So, and this is again, when I looked through the history of money, I found that this came up over and over again. You know, in ancient societies, it was really the temples that ran the place. They were in charge in a lot of ways. It was the temples and the temple support staff that were really in control, and that's where the money was being minted, and it was really being used just to fund the priests and the priestesses, because this is a very ancient concept that that priests and priestesses should not have jobs. You know, they shouldn't be paid for doing work. They're slaves of the gods, and their only form of sustenance that they're allowed to have is the donations from the public. So I found again that this same principle was at work in ancient Israel and in Rome. And then when you get to the Middle Ages, that's when what we know as the checking system was first invented. The idea that you can have a piece of paper that represents wealth as opposed to the coin that has the gold or the silver in it. That sort of concept was invented in the 1100s with the Knights Templar.
Uh-huh.
And again, so the Knights Templar, the poor knights of the Temple of Solomon, they're a medieval a group of warrior monks. It's a secret society, really, but it was created by the Pope, and they had, well, it wasn't created by the Pope, but it was sort of chartered by the church, and basically they had a law unto themselves. They were not beholden to anyone except the Pope, so they could set up their own independent territories wherever they wanted to in Europe. So what this led to after their job originally was to sort of lead the Crusades. They were the special forces in the Crusades. Mm-hmm. But after the Crusades, when that all finally died down, they needed something to do. They had this huge organization, and they had already started off with a little bit of money, because most of the members were from the cream of the aristocracy, and that when you joined, you had to donate money. So they had quite a bit of money to start with, but then they invented the system where, they were in charge of the routes to the Holy Land for pilgrims. That was one of their jobs during and after the Crusades, was to protect pilgrims en route to the Holy Land. Well, the way they thought to protect them from highway robbery. Because people were stealing their gold and silver, right? If you go on a pilgrimage, it was very common back then. If you go anywhere, if you're alone or underarmed or something, someone's going to come along and jack you for whatever you got. Mm-hmm. And so they invented this system where if you're a pilgrim, you can go from one church to the other. And at these churches, there'll be a Templar preceptory set up there with a bank in it. And so you can start off your pilgrimage by putting all of this gold and silver coin into the first Templar bank. And then they'll give you what they called a chit, which was a piece of paper coded with ciphered information that represented all the money in your account. And then as you go along the route, you stop at each Templar preceptory, and you can present your chit there, and they will help you get food and lodging and everything you need for that night, and they'll deduct it from your account. So that's how checking and banking was really invented.
See, and it already seems that, you know, just these couple of areas that you mentioned, now I got hung up on that bizarre intersection of the church and money and sex. And unfortunately, if we think of the present day, there's still that unfortunate, bizarre intersection of the church and sex as we see the constant abuse cases come. So you have that with the origins, millennia ago, and then what you kind of just described, essentially, in addition to creating the sort of, banking system, the check system, that it's kind of a protection racket as well.
Well, yeah, if you think about why they were able to do this, it really had to do with the fact that they had these independent preceptories, that it was basically like a little their own zone where they weren't part of the country surrounding them.
Uh-huh.
And Vatican City is the same way. And so many of these other tax havens, that's how they operate. Someone with a right of sovereignty, whether it's a king or queen or a government or some institution that has been, like the Vatican, that has been given or assumed to itself this sort of authority, they create their own little zone where they can make the rules. Washington, D.C. is another example.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the Federal Reserve is housed now, mm-hmm. which is the central bank of the United States. But it's really, as we're coming to learn these days, it's the central bank of the world.
Uh-huh.
That even though there's this thing called the IMF that controls the central banks of other mm-hmm. countries, they're really operating on behalf of the same people that control the Federal Reserve.
I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a documentary of really low production quality, but just jam-packed with amazing information, and it's really, really long, and it's sometimes referred to as the Ring of Power.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
And one of the things that I really kind of got from that is that we have those kind of three, you know, city states. We've got the District of Columbia, we've got Vatican City, and we've got the City of London.
Right, right.
And that I've always kind of seen that the District of Criminals seems to be, that's where the military power is, and the City of London, that's kind of where the money power is, and Vatican City, that's where the God power is, that it's one way or the other, we're going to get you, whether we have to get you with the military, the money, or God.
Mm-hmm. Well, an interesting thing about the City of London, too, is a lot of those banking institutions there on Fleet Street, a lot of the buildings actually started out as Templar buildings. Like, they had some headquarters there for a while.
Hmm.
And there's this place called Temple Bar, which is in the City of London proper. And that's where the bar for the lawyers is, and it's literally still the same, the building that the Templars were operating in many centuries ago.
Uh-huh.
But just to get, I know we're moving along on our time.
Here we are. I'm trying to keep an eye on the clock to try and cover as much as we can. So please.
Well, it's just I guess as we're telling the story of money, and I told you about how the Templars sort of invented the checking system, that quickly evolved into what became known as fractional reserve lending,
mm-hmm.
based on the same principles. I can't draw a conspiratorial connection between the medieval goldsmiths that started this and the Templars, but there's a conceptual link. I mean, they would have gotten their inspiration from the mm-hmm. Templars. And what they were doing, basically at that time, I'm talking about late 1200s on to about the 1500s or so, there was people who were doing banking back then. Mainly, they were just vaults. They were holding people's money for a fee. They were holding people's gold and silver. And a lot of times it was the goldsmiths, the people who actually minted the coins. They also had on the side this vault where they would make money holding people's gold and silver. Well, they came up with this idea that basically they noticed that only one out of every 10 people who had an account there would ever come in to inspect their holdings or withdraw their holdings at any given time. They came up with this mathematical formula, this ratio, where they were able to predict when someone was going to call to get their mm-hmm. money or how often someone mm-hmm. was going to do it. And then they said to themselves, well, this means that we can do whatever we want with the rest of the money and no one will ever notice. And as long as we always have some money to give those people.
Uh-huh, to cover that one guy or two that mathematically we see may come in and want their stuff, whether it, you know, some, you know, family emergency or some situation that, of course, isn't going to happen to all 10 people at once.
Right. So what that means is it's a license to print money, mm-hmm. basically. When you decide to do that, then what you can do is, and this is what they did, they would loan the gold out to other people at interest, and then they would get payments back from that, obviously profiting from it. And thus they were able to increase, they were able to make money out of nothing, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because you'd think that if you're giving gold to someone for safekeeping and then they're loaning it out to someone else, that's fraud. But
it would seem to be.
Somehow this became institutionalized and normalized, and then they started extending the Templar concept of checking onto this, so that instead of actually taking physical gold out of their vaults mm-hmm. from the depositors and loaning them out to someone else, they'll just say, okay, we'll give you credit. And here's a check that represents credit from the bank, and that'll be a loan, and then you pay us back mm-hmm. with interest. So they don't even have to remove the gold that's in their vaults in order to run that sort of scheme. But as long as they have something there uh-huh. for the mathematical likelihood that a certain number of people are going to come and look for it or withdraw. So anyway, yeah, again, somehow that got institutionalized and normalized, and eventually that was the principle that uh-huh. the Bank of England was founded on. This was the fractional reserve lending. That's what they called it. And it became normal to run a bank this way, and then in England, that was actually the way that the national currency was issued from the Central Bank of England. So you then had a society dependent upon money being issued from a bank that's creating it out of nothing. And here's the weirdest part, is they're loaning it to the government. So if you live in any country on Earth today, this is probably how your society works, uh-huh. is that they have a bank called the Central Bank creating money out of nothing, selling it to the government on interest, uh-huh. and then you, as the taxpayer, have to make good on that loan.
And that's what we've seen now playing out in, whether it's here or whether it's in Iceland or countries all around the world, this same kind of scenario has played out where all of a sudden people go, well, where's all that money? I even wonder sometimes as a little kid. Little kids, of course, have natural, good, inquisitive natures. That as a little kid, you wonder when you go to the bank with your mom or you maybe go through the drive-thru, it's like, gosh, they have everybody's money in there? No, they don't. And that's, I'm saying, even a childlike inquisitiveness would go, they have all the money in there? And of course, no. The answer is no, they don't have all the money in there.
No, well, it's funny. Okay, I've been describing how a central bank works, but the commercial banks are working on the same principle. Mm-hmm. What's going on is the central bank produces a paper currency, and then they deposit a certain amount of that into these member banks, because in the United States and in other countries, you have to be a member of the system controlled by the central bank mm-hmm. in order to operate legally. So then you get your reserve funds, as they call them, from the central bank. Those would be the same as the piece of gold in the goldsmith's vault that represents 10 pieces of gold that have been loaned out. Mm-hmm. Those are the reserves. Well, in our system, it's a paper reserve. So the bank, Chase Manhattan Bank, for instance, you go into Chase Bank, they only have one out of every $10. And actually, it's a lot worse than that now. That's the standard rate, is one out of 10. Well, nowadays, it's even less. It's like one out of 26, one out of 50, depending on, mm-hmm. you know, what's going, what, because the Federal Reserve sets that rate, and uh-huh. they change it constantly. So anyway, it could be significantly less than one. But anyway, so they only have one paper dollar for every 10 that they're mm-hmm. creating through loans and checkbook money and things like that, all made out of nothing. And the only thing that they've got is this one piece of paper. But the funny thing is that piece of paper itself doesn't represent anything. If you take that all the way back to the Federal Reserve, they're not going to give you anything. Uh-huh. You know, that's what it is what it is. It only exists as wealth because we believe in it, which is what my two books about money really explore, mm-hmm. is the concept that this is really a mystical idea, that that money only exists because we believe in it, that it's a magical ritual in a way. It's anyone who's sort of familiar with ritual magic or that these mystical ideas where you create your own reality, that is in action. That principle is in action in our economic system. The only reason why any of this stuff functions, any of the economic system functions, is because people accept these pieces of paper as representing gold, mm-hmm. basically, as representing wealth, even though, you know, it's not a secret, it's open, it's out in the open, that there's really nothing behind it. So it's very weird. It's like Wile E. Coyote, when he chases the Roadrunner off the cliff, and then they're like standing there in midair, And at a certain point, the Roadrunner points down and points out to the coyote that, hey, we're just standing here on the air. And he looks down, and it's when he looks down and realizes that he's standing in midair, that's when he finally starts to fall.
See now, and I wonder if that could be, as we see, you know, gold and silver and these things becoming so much more important now, and the recent stories about, you know, J.P. Morgan, you know, kind of gaming the silver market and this push to buy silver to even maybe hurt J.P. Morgan. And the move to gold and, you know, these precious metal moves, these things have only become, you know, more thought about and talked about now. But we now have, I'm not sure if you had stepped into the studios and heard me mention it, that Ron Paul is now going to be the head of a House committee that oversees the Federal Reserve. So we have one of the biggest critics of the Federal Reserve who's now going to be one of its overseers. And my fear is that a scenario like this could just be used to play back into their hands, that if we get an audit of the Fed, they're going to go, oh gosh, you're right, it is a big mess, didn't we screw up, I guess we just need more control, and next time we won't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I like Ron Paul, and I think that that is a very worthy effort to be made. I'm wary, though, of this push to return to a gold standard or a gold and silver standard. The thing is that there's a finite amount of that stuff on Earth, and the people that have the most of it aren't normal people. You know, it's the elite again. And so it's like that's just another control mechanism for them. They had no problem controlling the economy back when there was a gold standard. The only reason why we don't have a gold standard now is because all of the gold was taken in 1933 as we basically went into bankruptcy at that point to the Fed. The country went into bankruptcy to its own central bank.
In the first Great Depression.
Right. So, and then they literally, in order to make a payment on that debt, confiscated all the gold that people had in their possession.
And I'm sure, you know, there are some of our grandparents and folks who can even remember that.
Right. And I know. And it's like, well, how come you didn't warn us? I mean, but
about a scenario where a sort of controlled demolition of an economy is pulled off, and we're seeing it just kind of play out again.
Well, yeah, and so my fear for the future is that this is the same thing happening again. We're going into bankruptcy again, and last time there was a demand of a payment of some sort of real physical property. Now, what are they going to demand this time? I mean, so far we're seeing bailout bills, and we're seeing austerity measures where they want to sort of decrease government expenditures and increase taxes in order to increase the payments that your government can make on its debt to banks.
And it's interesting because as these things happen, and of course, you know, austerity was a word I think, you know, none of us had ever really heard before. Amazingly enough, folks like Webster Tarpley were the first to start saying, now watch, with all this, they're going to start talking austerity. And he was right on that point, because then all of a sudden this word kind of from out of the past becomes a you know, standard usage in the news now.
Well, what's really going on here is, okay, we're finally being initiated into truths that people in Europe and other parts of the world have known for a long time. The reports on the IMF and what sort of agreements they're making with your country's central bank, that's something that's commonly on the news in other countries. Mm-hmm. They are aware of the fact that there are foreign banks loaning their country money and making agreements with their governments about what they're going to extract from the people in order to make good on those loans.
From those, the human resources.
But, and I think part of it is the fact that we have the Federal Reserve here. The Federal Reserve is really one of the main powers behind the IMF. And so when we hear about our monetary policy and what's going on, we just hear about the Fed. We don't hear about the IMF. The IMF is integrally involved. Mm-hmm. And in fact, here's an interesting fact. The head of the Treasury Department has dual titles. One of his titles is he's the director of North America for the IMF. So when he gets sworn in as Treasury Secretary, he's also getting sworn in for that title, too.
So essentially really serving the globalists, the higher-ups.
Right. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what you come away with when you look into this stuff. That, okay, the government really is a corporation, and it's owned by other private corporations, by banks specifically. And the capital that they're working with is us. You know, the money that they're inventing out of nothing and trading around, what it actually is based on, what they're really trading, is the people that these governments control and their future productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another thing I get into in Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, which is my new book on alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
I get more into this these alchemical metaphors having to do with how the economy functions sort of as a slave grid. And amazingly, there's direct connections with the metaphors of alchemy. If you look at alchemical manuscripts from the Middle Ages, they're all written in code and very esoteric language. It's really hard to figure out what they're talking about. And there's many different ways to interpret them. But one of the ways you can literally interpret it is you can say the modern economy functions by the same principles that are being laid out in these alchemical manuscripts, where they're talking about basically rituals, ways of rituals to go through in order to sort of suspend your own disbelief and create wealth, create gold out of nothing. And then there's procedures for multiplying a small amount of gold into a large amount of gold. And the descriptions of this, it's literally the same way that that fractional reserve lending works. I mean, it's kind of freaky when you look at these old alchemical manuscripts and you realize, wow, they could be describing the banking system. It's the same thing. And then there's also these metaphors about, okay, literally, grinding up babies and boiling them and sort of reducing them to a pulp, to a something that the alchemists called the prima materia, that this is basically the stuff out of which gold is made. And they said that you could find it in the elements all over the earth, but you need to go through this process in order to reduce it to the prima materia so you can make gold. And it was when I started looking at that, specifically at this text called the Book of Abraham the Jew, where they're describing this and using metaphors about children and sacrificing them, basically, that I realized, oh, wow, there's another metaphor that can be applied to the economy. We are being used as the prima materia, we and our children. And that's a major part of it, especially now. Now more than ever, the money that our governments are borrowing from these banks, they don't have any collateral left for them anymore except the projected future productivity of your children.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, it's like, it's, yeah, it's alchemy, but it's a level of alchemy that we haven't even really engaged in until recently, to actually steal from the future in order to create wealth out of nothing here.
And that, I mean, that sounds like magic. That sounds like the definition of magic.
Yes.
Stealing from the future.
Well, and I also got into the idea of the Matrix, because the Matrix is, we've all seen the movie, but it's a real concept. It's been around at least since the Gnostics, and you could trace it back earlier, but the concept that we're all in sort of a fake reality, that we're under an illusion being controlled by someone else, and that in the Matrix, okay, they have babies that are, or people that are in, they're suspended in goo, right? And they've got something like, they're being used as a battery. They've got some sort of machine taking the energy away from them, and in order to run some other machine somewhere else. Well, that really is happening here, you know. We go through life just sort of in a trance, really. You know, if you actually contemplated why you're going to work every day and where the money, a lot of the money is going to, you wouldn't do it. So you have to just sort of force yourself to be in this hypnotic trance.
And you try and forget about all that with you know, food and fun and drink and all those things that we do all enjoy and that all, of course, have their place, but we're using them just to shut out the harsh reality, I think.
The harsh reality that you're a slave, and that if you didn't go through that routine every day, if people just stopped doing that, then the system couldn't function the way it does, which doesn't mean that we couldn't have a system.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, and saying that makes me think of, I wanted to mention earlier that, you know, we see, as we talk about austerity, you know, in Europe, and we see protests breaking out massively. You know, we had Prince Charles and Camilla, their car attacked the other day with people even screaming off with their heads, protesting, you know, fee hikes and in the recent events in France with raising the retirement age. People have hit the streets angry. Now, here in the States, millions of people losing their homes. And there seems to be nary a peep other than, I think, these bizarre kind of outbursts where you see these kind of shooter events and the more erratic behavior going on. What, I mean, what's your take on perhaps what may be coming for the States and what we could try and avoid before it hits us?
Well, again, I think that this has a lot to do with the fact that you've got more of a socialized type government in Europe. People are more used to having their needs met by the government. Mm-hmm. And when that's taken away, you know, there's an instantaneous reaction of, hey, that's mine. I was using that, you know. And here we just don't have that. So when times are bad, people turn on themselves and on each other and not the government. Mm-hmm. But I think in Europe, I think they really understand the fact that the money is being created out of nothing. And that is what makes it just so unbelievable that when a bank creates money out of nothing, loans it to someone else, and then the person can't pay it back, so they lose on that investment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hey, they weren't losing anything. They made it out of nothing, right? But somehow the debt gets passed on to the government and then to the people, and we're supposed to take our real property and our real labor, our blood, sweat, and tears to make good on that debt somehow. You know, I think that Europeans really understand how offensive that is. Mm-hmm. And I think Americans still are just now learning. And unfortunately, a lot of the anger directed towards the Fed right now is coming from Tea Party people. Uh-huh. And, you know, they're being informed by Glenn Beck a lot of uh-huh. the times. And, you know, not to criticize him too much, but it seems like they have this attitude that there's a limited amount of stuff on Earth, and that if someone else gets something for free, then that's taking something away from you.
Hmm.
But in this case where money is being created out of nothing and someone loses some money that was created out of nothing, it's more of an injustice to take stuff, real physical stuff, uh-huh. away from someone else in order to make good on that. But, you know, for it's like they're so hung up on making everyone work for what they've got that they would be really angry if the government did anything to give something away. And so what I'm finding is that a lot of the Tea Party people are just more upset about tax expenditures, like welfare and things like mm-hmm. that are just a drop in the bucket uh-huh. compared to the rest of the budget. They're just so hung up on what the other people getting something for free.
Uh-huh.
And they're not looking at the larger picture of how they're being raped every day and mm-hmm. how this whole system is fraudulent from the get-go. And, you know, so what I find is that I think Glenn Beck, maybe he's not doing this knowingly, but I think he's sort of a merchant of austerity measures. Mm. And I think that the new Republican Party in Congress right now, a lot of them brought in by the Tea Party, mm-hmm. unfortunately, it's the same thing. They're in place right now basically to sell us the idea that we can somehow take the burden off of our children and grandchildren by paying more taxes now and by receiving less in government expenditures.
That's austerity.
Right. But no, you can't make that work unless you remove the parasitical banking system.
Mm-hmm.
Because
the giant vampire squid, as it's been recently called.
Yeah, I mean, the problem isn't even necessarily that they're making money out of nothing. That's not the issue. It's the fact that we have to pay it back with
exactly.
real stuff.
Exactly.
And that there's an interest tacked onto it.
Which,
for some reason,
as something I reported on earlier in the episode, is what would be immoral, is usury. It has, for a long time, to just kind of briefly touch back into the ancient times that still connect to today, that it would be immoral.
Yes, yes. I think it's from Ezekiel. There's some great passage that I love to quote when I can remember it. But it goes like, he who lends upon usury shall not live. You know, it's basically it's all in, or maybe it's in Leviticus, okay? Because it's amongst a bunch of other lists of things that you'll get killed for doing.
Uh-huh.
You know, like picking up sticks on the Sabbath or something like that. But yeah, it was definitely considered one of the deadly sins in the ancient world, and it's because it's illogical. Well, one of the things they used to have was a jubilee. Like every 7 years in Israel, if you hadn't been able to pay off your debt after 7 years of carrying it, then it would be discharged. Mm-hmm. Everyone's debts would be discharged throughout the whole community. It's because with compound interest,
there's no way
you can never pay.
Yeah.
You know, and so it ends up destroying society, really. And so I think that's why they instituted the jubilee. And I think we basically have to have something like that go on globally. We need to have a global default on these debts that cannot be paid.
Tracy Twyman, unfortunately, we were so quickly running out of time here, and we now kind of have to wrap it up, and there are so many kind of other areas that I think folks would really be interested in. But let me just kind of briefly read a bit of the back from your latest book, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. Glimpse the hidden truth about the history of money and the secret science of alchemy. In this volume, Tracy Twyman reveals how the entire global economy is based upon the principles and processes of this royal art. Discover the connections between economics and ghastly rituals from the past that include child sacrifice, eating human flesh, and bathing in blood, the occult origins of the dollar symbol, Baphomet, the Knights Templar, all that and so much more. Tell folks how they can get their hands on a copy of this book.
Well, if you go to TracyRTwyman.com, you can find links to it all over the place. QuintessentialPublications.com will also work. And you can just use your credit card or PayPal to purchase it. And we've got a special going on right now from now through Saturnalia, through the end of Saturnalia, which is basically the end of December. And you can get Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge and Solomon's Treasure and a DVD of my podcast all for $29.95 with free shipping. So it's a real good deal.
Excellent. And see, and we didn't even mention that you also put out the Invisible Hand podcast. There's, you know, so many things. And again, I thank you for taking, you know, even this little brief time to come in here and share your information.
Oh, yeah. It was a pleasure. I love being on the show.
I think we'll have to, we'll have to continue this again as I think, you know, there are massive changes going on, you know, both externally and internally, that as things seem to be falling apart, it's going to become even more important to really vote with our dollars. And I think for folks, you know, if you find alternative media and these independent, non-commercial, non-corporate outlets, you know, empowering and interesting and entertaining, it's easy to throw a little bit of money. You know, some of the money would easily be spent at a night at the bar.
I was going to say, it's like, you could buy two or three drinks at some bars with this amount of money. You know?
Or you could support your favorite, you know, alternative media hosts, and that would, you know, myself, Clyde Lewis, Tracy, Corbett Report, Tragedy, and, you know, all these outlets that, again, we're just trying to spread this information, because obviously something's happening and something's changing, and we just need to kind of be forewarned.
Well, something's changing, and it would be better if we could change it in the way that we want instead of the way that they want, you know?
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Tracy R. Twyman, author, researcher, the new book, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks.
So, folks, that's going to do it for this, can you believe it, 199th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. So quickly, as we wrap it up here, we'll remind you yet again that next week we're taking Christmas Eve off, but there will be my Best of the Year mixtape to take its place, and we will return New Year's Eve, December 31st, with the 200th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. I don't want to belabor it or spend any more time on it, my friends, but you know, I can't do this without you, and I really appreciate it. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, reminding you, as always, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care.
whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.